Ahem. In last week's edition of Cromford's Assortment, it was wrongly alleged that the actress Sharon Phillips had been Peter O'Toole's husband. We would like to point out that in actual fact, Sharon Phillips's husband was, at one time, married to Peter O'Toole's wife, and that there was nothing improper in this. Paul Cromford Productions would like to apologise for any incontinence caused by their error.
Hello, and welcome to Cromford's Assortment on Thursday, the 21st of May, 2020. On this day, the 21st of May, 1688, Alexander Pope, poet and satirist, was born. How many of us unfortunate English Lit students had to endure his Epistle to Dr. Arbuthnot for A-level, eh?
Shut
the door, good John. Fatigued, I said. Tie up the knocker, say I'm sick, I'm dead.
Bloody thing. On this day in 1780, Elizabeth Fry, the English Quaker, social reformer and glamour girl of the old £5 note, was born. She advocated more humane treatment for prisoners, but would never, ever tell Patrick McGoohan who number one was. Do you call that humane? Because I don't. On this day in 1894, the Manchester Ship Canal was officially opened by Queen Victoria, after she'd spent the previous 14 years digging it out and lining it with a PVC membrane. She was a plucky little worker, that woman. On this day in 1904, the great Fats Waller, keyboard virtuoso and singer who co-wrote Ain't Misbehaving. And Honeysuckle Rose. Among many others, was born. On this day in 1916, the clocks in Britain went forward 1 hour for the first ever period of British summertime. And we've been bamboozling ourselves with adjustments twice a year ever since. On this day in 1927, Charles Lindbergh landed his plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, in Paris, becoming the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic. Funnily enough, also on this day in 1932, Amelia Earhart landed her plane in Culmore, Northern Ireland, so becoming the first person who wasn't a man to fly solo across the Atlantic. On this day in 1941, British folk icon Martin Carthy was born. My abiding memory of him is watching him accidentally nut his vocal mic during a gig at a tiny pub in Brighton around the turn of the millennium. It went thunk, by the way. It was very satisfying. On this day in 1949, director David Lean, one of Britain's greatest film talents, married the actress Anne Todd, who, wasn't. On this day in 1966, heavyweight boxer Henry Cooper was spifflicated in a title fight by world champion Muhammad Ali, or Cassius Clay as he probably was then. Our Henry used to bleed a lot, that was his problem. The 21st of May is International Tea Day. Well, it takes all sorts, I suppose. And finally, the 21st of May is also World Day for Cultural Diversity. Does that mean I can say I'd rather stick my ears in a waffle iron than go anywhere near China, and nobody can get stupidly PC about it because I'm respecting our cultural diversity? Now, the first time I saw and heard this next chap, he was performing the routine you're about to hear now. I think it was one of those Amnesty International secret policeman's ball type events, and it was obvious straight away that this man was going to go far. If sarcasm can be raised to an art form, this bloke was Botticelli. Rowan Atkinson, schoolmaster.
Right, quiet. Ainsley. Babcock. Bland. Cart horse. Dint. Ellsworth Beast Major. Ellsworth Beast Minor. Fiat. German. Hemoglobin. Have a nut. Jones M. Jones M. Kosigan. Loud Hailer. Mattock. Nancy Boy Possum. Come on, settle down. Orifice. Plectrum. Coins. Sediment. Soda. Tack. Under manager. Wicket. Williams Wicket. Williams Witcherly. Witcherly Wicket. Witcherly Williams. And Witcherly Williams. Wicket. Zob. Absent. All right, your essays. Discuss the contention that Cleopatra had the body of a roll-top desk and the mind of a duck. Oxford and Cambridge Board, O-level paper, 1976. Don't fidget, Bland. The answer, yes. Jones M, orifice, sediment, and under manager. See me afterwards. Most of you, of course, didn't write nearly enough. Dint, your answer was unreadable. Put it away, plectrum. If I see it once more this period, plectrum, I shall have to tweak you. Do you have a solicitor? You're live, plectrum, so I shall tweak you anyway. See me afterwards to be tweaked. Yes, isn't life tragic? Don't sulk, boy, for God's sake. Has matron seen those boils? Horrid little twerp. Bland. German Nancy Boy Potter under manager cribbing. Under manager answer upside down. Do you do it deliberately under manager? You're a moron under manager, what are you? A carbuncle on the backside of humanity. Don't snigger, Babcock. It's not funny. Antony and Cleopatra is not a funny play. If Shakespeare had meant it to be funny, he would have put a joke in it. There is no joke in Antony and Cleopatra. You know that if you read it, wouldn't you, Babcock? Pissed. What play of Shakespeare's does have a joke in it, then? Anyone? The Comedy of Errors, for God's sake. The Comedy of Errors has the joke of two people looking like each other. Twice. It's not that funny, German. And the other Shakespearean joke is nibble. Nibble! Leave orifice alone. What a lot. Right, for the rest of this period, you will write about Ina Barbas. Under manager, just try and write Ina Barbas. Either way, boy, I'm not bothered. Usual conditions, no conferring, no eating, no cheating, no looking out through windows, no slang, no slide rules. Use ink only via a nib, if possible. You may use dividers, but not on each other. Kosygin, you're in charge.
Pattercake Moore is very well known to us as an astronomer, so much so that his talents as a xylophone player have been unfairly overlooked. I had considered asking him to zoom us a quick solo recital, but he's currently sharing Marriott Frinton's isolation and he doesn't have his instrument with him. However, I did stumble across the following audio file when I was browsing online a few days ago, and I'm going to play it for you exactly as is, because I think it speaks for itself.
Hello, I'm... well, you know who I am, but you probably don't know any of my friends here with me today. On drums, Mr. Fred Kepler. On tuba, Mr. Ernie Herschel. On accordion, Miss Ariadne Hubble. And on guitar, Mr. Leo Galli. With myself, of course, on the xylophone. We call ourselves the 12.5-inch reflectors. And although we may look quite fuddy-duddy to most people, you'll be pleasantly surprised at our chops, I think. We're going to play our own rather jolly version of a popular tune called What Are You Pouting For? And to get myself into the right frame of mind for the introduction, Ariadne is going to tell me a saucy joke. What are you pouting for?
We'll be right back.
Yes, well, I think we need to tidy that ending up a bit.
Yes. I suspect that what are you pouting for is really called Why Pout? Here's another chance to try before you buy. Admittedly, the book I'm about to read from was published 25 years ago, but if you're a particular kind of music fan of a certain age and you haven't come across this book yet, I promise you, you'd get a lot out of it. It's called Lost in Music by the music journalist Giles Smith. I'll entice you with a quote from Sebastian Foulkes, which is part of the blurb on the back page of my copy. It says, "A wonderfully funny pop music memoir. You don't have to know who Nick Kershaw is to laugh out loud at the chapter about him." I think on the strength of that blurb alone, I bought the book. So, bearing in mind we now stream most of the music we listen to, and all of our CDs are beginning to look like quaint and cumbersome relics, here are Giles Smith's reflections on how the coming of CDs affected his vinyl collecting. The late 1980s and the early 1990s were years of great political and sociological shift. It was a period in which old orders began to fall away, yielding ground to the vital green shoots pushing through from beneath. There was the collapse of communism and the troubled ascendance of new democracies in Eastern Europe. There was the transition, in Britain, from vinyl to compact disc. CD. It was always going to be a tough one. So many of us were rooted in the traditional way of things, bitterly resistant to change, vinyl dependent. The record companies and the hi-fi manufacturers did their best to calm the inevitable popular unrest. Given the money at stake, it was, of course, in their interest to do so. We heard a lot in those early days about the stunning improvement in sound quality that compact disc was going to bring us. How the new format was capable of a glassy clarity of which our old vinyl records could only dream. We were fed copious propaganda about the discs' indestructibility, how they were scratch-proof, dust-proof, waterproof, how you could heat them up, roll them into little tubes, stuff them with prawns, serve them as hors d'oeuvres at cocktail parties, and they still sounded brilliant. Here, we were promised, was a music format that would not degenerate with use. A pet is for life, but a CD is forever. Play them as many times as you like, they said, and no quality loss. Of course, no one has really been around long enough yet to offer proper guarantees on this. Recently, a few science wizards have expressed doubts about CD permanence, raising the dire prospect that one day, say in 30 years' time, all that encoded digital information will soak out of them, and your entire collection will turn to blank plastic in a matter of hours. Just thinking about this now, as someone with major holdings in compact disc, I can sense the colour draining from my face. I have not come this far, I feel, to be left with a vanload of neatly boxed frisbees. It would be a rich irony, though. Everything else about compact discs looks permanent enough. Certainly by contrast with 12-inch vinyl. They are extremely difficult to snap. They don't turn into salad bowls if left in the sun on the back shelf of a car. And although they can jump, be jogged, get stuck, skitter, and generally play up, it's unusual when they do. Naturally, I was wary in those early days. I thought it was best to consider first the domestic implications and then work carefully outwards from there. It was readily apparent that compact discs were going to be an easier thing to bring home from the shops. Here was something in their favour. They wouldn't flap about wantonly in the wind like albums, and you were far less likely to cause injury by jamming one between your knee and the handrail coming down the stairs on the bus home, which happened with me and a vinyl copy of Heaven 17's Penthouse and Pavement. A cosmetic wounding only, but still nasty. My knee didn't come out of it all that well either. And transporting CDs thereafter, taking them to other people's houses, was clearly going to be considerably simpler too. The only plastic bags which fit a 12-inch record being bags from record shops, and if you happen not to have any of those knocking around the house, then you've got a problem. As you'll know, if you've ever tried to wedge a couple of albums into a standard supermarket carrier bag, that they go in just about okay, though at the risk of snubbed corners, but then you can't bring the bag's handles together. No, the durability and convenience arguments struck me as winningly solid. Mostly, I was concerned about the sleeve situation. To one reared on the open plains of the album cover, the images at the front of compact discs were comically cramped. They looked like snapshots of record covers, and, like snapshots, they had a mostly disappointing relation to the real thing. Plus, that half inch of thinly ridged grey plastic down the left-hand side was an ugly distraction. This wasn't how music was meant to look. Did they really mean us to stare at these things and solemnly pass them around while the album was playing? So, I chewed worriedly for quite a while before I bought into the CD dream. I would cast anxious looks at my shelved LPs and remember how much of me was invested there. I didn't like the idea of them being outstripped by time. I wasn't keen to see them go the way of the oil lamp and the horse-drawn plough. People would say, "So, do you think you'll get a CD then?" And I would say, "No, I don't reckon. Because of the sleeves. I'd miss the sleeves." And they would nod and say, "Exactly, exactly." But then, at some point in 1987, a friend became the first person we knew to own a CD player, and a group of us went ritually to his house one evening and clumped upstairs into his bedroom to give it an audition. "Listen to this," he said. "What?" I said, hearing nothing. "That," he said. It was the nothing he wanted me to listen to, the silence between the tracks. And it was impressive, the total absence of clutter. No swishing of needle in dusty groove, no ticks and spits from the encrusted grit, no soft lumping where the plastic arse end of the stylus humped rhythmically against the vinyl, which happened on some of my more spectacularly warped singles. And here was the neurosis-inducing corollary. If all that noise was going on between the tracks, it was going on during them too. It became apparent that everything you were hearing on vinyl was struggling to shrug off a thin coat of fuzz or hiss to reach you. Its immediacy drastically diminished. CD, a miracle, offered sound in the nude, as the good Lord intended it, hosed down, fanatically scrubbed, beautifully oiled, punching and popping out at you from this perfect digital hush. If you're a genuine vinyl fetishist, this perpetual flawlessness is a mixed blessing. Records left their mark on you, and in the spirit of cooperation, you left your mark on records. What hope for this two-way relationship if CDs have the gift of eternal youth? Yet, I confess, on the whole, I don't find it hilarious and touching that my copy of Aretha Franklin's greatest hits is so badly pressed, or so shockingly mastered, that the sound suddenly clarifies and swells in volume, bang in the middle of Chain of Fools, the third track on side one. Nor am I encouraged to shed tears of nostalgia over the two jumps which happen inside the first 10 seconds of Ricky Don't Lose That Number, on my copy of Steely Dan's Pretzel Logic. Grit inside the inner sleeve, I think. The music format which was going to rescue me from these mini-dramas couldn't come quickly enough. So, the combined weight of the industry propaganda and my own accumulated anxieties that there was this format out there which was somehow truer, more faithful, built up and swung me over. Finally, grindingly, I chose CD. Not that my decision meant anything. The record companies, in collusion with the hi-fi manufacturers, had already decided long ago that we would all change to this new, more expensive format. And they got their way by the simple expedient of slowing down vinyl production and drastically limiting our opportunity to do anything else other than butt out altogether, and that wasn't an option. It was never a question of fighting. It was only ever a matter of how peacefully you would give yourself up. And after a brief, inconsequential paddy, I ran, gurgling, into CD's outstretched arms. In 1988, I scraped the money together for a cheap Philips X-Display model. It had a rather unsatisfying rubberized push pad on the front for stop, start, forward and reverse, and the disc tray emerged with a creaky metallic rumble, like a train going slowly over points. And of course, I took the solemn oath that everyone takes when they first trade up to CDs, that I would never waste money buying on CD anything I already owned on record. Because, though my new CD player was clearly crunchier to listen to and less troubled sounding than my old record deck, and though it gave me the promised silence between the tracks, it still had to pass through the rest of my battered hi-fi, my weary amplifier and baggy speakers, so the improvement wasn't exactly quantum. The sound was slightly smarter, as if freshly ironed, and that was about it. In fact, as I furtively admitted to myself in occasional moments of punishing honesty, some of the old vinyl sounded more lively for a few creases, a bit of air and static. So, no pointless duplication of albums, no CD and vinyl overlap. My decision to go compact was, I avowed, a simple piece of company rationalising in response to the new technology, but with no redundancies. The vinyl collection had its job to do and always would have. Hollow words. Even as I was pledging, I was buying my first CD, Characters by Stevie Wonder, an album I had bought and been quietly disappointed by only 6 months previously on vinyl. The CD had two additional tracks, so I suppose I can justify this on some academic basis. But even so, how easily I was lured in. And ever since then, with increasing alacrity, I have shopped wildly for CD versions of records I already possess, prowled the browsers wide-eyed and tensed up, as if I was involved in some mad, self-generated game of Snap. Album sales were in decline before the arrival of CD. When people like me started going out and buying our record collections all over again, well, blow me down if they didn't start surging back upwards. It's a perfectly legitimate ambition for any business in a consumer society, getting us to buy something we do not need. And long may it continue, because all of my favourite things are things I do not, under any serious analysis, need. But only the record business, fabulously shameless in every stunt it pulls, has managed so seamlessly the ultimate marketing trick. Getting us to buy something we do not need, which we've already got. Now it's time for On the Trot, where I suggest something that you can stick in your ears to go for your daily walk or your daily jog. This week's trotter comes from XTC in 1989, and it's one of Colin Moulding's little beauties. I have to say, I've never latched on to Andy Partridge's XTC songs. I think he's living proof that you can be too clever for your own good. Colin Moulding was kind of the acceptable face of XTC. He was the Paul McCartney to Andy Partridge's Vlad the Impaler. Anyway, get those limbs loping loosely to King for a Day.
Creeping up to the money guard.
And that's all I've got for you this week. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, make a date for next week's programme, Thursday the 28th of May. In the meantime, keep a grip on yourself, be patient, stay sane, safe and well. I made this programme for you, and I'm going to be here sending them out as long as you're there to receive them. When we do come out of all this, let's not go back to normal, because there was a lot about the old normal that was pretty crap when you come to think about it. Why don't we see whether we can make a different normal, a better normal, one that will do us proud? Oh, that's enough waffle. Bye for now. Cromford's Assortment was conceived, assembled and presented by me, Paul Cromford. I don't own the XTC song King for a Day, the Safaris tune Wipeout, or the talents of Rowan Atkinson. I just borrowed them to entertain you. All incidental music throughout the programme was written by me, Paul Cromford. This was a Paul Cromford production aimed right between your eyes.